7BR Pot Heard.
Hello, I'm Reese Palmer, Chambers' new paralegal. I've taken over from Eleanor Day, who left Chambers recently as she'll be beginning her pupillage year in April. On behalf of everyone at 7BR, we wish Ellie the best of luck and hope that she has a successful and fulfilling career. I'll be taking over 7BR's Pot Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. We're joined today by Chambers Head of Employment, Elaine Banton. Elaine has specialised in employment, equality and discrimination law from the outset of her career, representing private companies, public sector bodies, charities and individuals as claimants and respondents in multi-strand discrimination matters and high-value and complex trials across all levels of tribunals and courts. She regularly appears in appeals at all levels. She's the co-author of the chapter on human rights and employment law for Tolley's Employment Law and speaks and writes regularly on her specialist areas of law. She's the co-chair of the Bar Council's Equality, Diversity and Social Mobility Committee and an elected member of the GMC, member of the Temple Women's Forum Committee, co-chair of Middle Temple's Race Equality, Inclusion and Anti-Racism Working Group, and a bencher at Middle Temple. Elaine, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
So today we're talking about the judgment of Uber and Aslam, which was handed down on the 19th of February of this year. Before we delve into the decision that the judges made, perhaps you could provide us with a bit of a background and how we've ended up at the Supreme Court.
Well, yes, of course. Happy to do so. As you will be familiar with, I'm sure as we all are, Uber drivers accept rides via an app. And I think you'll agree the word Uber is now pretty much synonymous with the app, with the Uber drivers themselves. So in this case, the issue of worker status arose, which is, are they workers entitled to national minimum wage, paid leave and other benefits, or independent contractors? This was a preliminary issue to be determined in the employment tribunal. It was, in fact, decided in the driver's favour in the employment tribunal, then also in the driver's favour in the EAT. In the Court of Appeal, it was a majority decision with Lord Justice Underhill dissenting. Then finally, the UK Supreme Court delivered a unanimous decision with the speech, the lead speech, being given by Lord Leggett. The force behind these claims, to paraphrase paragraph 71 of the judgment, is really to protect vulnerable workers from being paid too little for the work that they do, or being required to work excessive hours or subjected to unfair treatment, such as victimisation for whistleblowing. The case is likely to now be remitted back to the tribunal to finally determine the existing claims unless they are resolved. It's a landmark decision that clarified two distinct points. One, a tribunal should examine the reality of the relationship between the parties and not be bound by what the documentation states. The ET was found to be correct to hold that Uber drivers were workers and not self-employed subcontractors. Secondly, the drivers are workers from the moment they switch on their apps and are available for work in their area to the time that they switch off their apps at the end of the day, or if they were on a break, for example.
So you've used the words workers and self-employed contractors or independent contractors. Could you perhaps just explain the difference between them and why that's sort of relevant in this case?
Yes, there is a quite important difference between them. Independent contractors are in business on their own account and undertake work for their clients or their customers. However, workers provide their services as part of a business undertaking carried on by somebody else. Therefore, they are considered more dependent on and subordinate to the terms of the business. So they are granted greater protection than fully self-employed people. So that's the major distinction, really.
And so Uber were trying to say that their drivers were not workers and were self-employed contractors. What were the main reasons and justifications behind this?
Yes, it was a mainly contractual argument being put forward. Uber relied on its contractual documentation And in order to work for Uber, drivers had to sign a services agreement. Under this contract, Uber agreed to provide technology services to drivers, being the app, locate customers, etc. And drivers agreed to provide transportation services to passengers. Under the agreement, drivers expressly agreed that Uber did not provide transportation services, and that by accepting customers' requests for transportation services, the driver created a contract with the passenger only. So effectively, Uber argued that there was no contract existing between Uber and the drivers, and that the relevant contract was between Uber and the passengers. Uber said that the employment tribunal, which had ruled in the driver's favour, was wrong to hold that they were workers because it disregarded, without any clear legal justification, the unambiguous terms of the written contracts.
What reasons would Uber have for not wanting to classify their drivers as workers? I know you've touched upon this, but if you could provide just a bit more detail.
Yes, I think I've touched on it in terms of benefits that might follow from that classification. So in a nutshell, one of the main issues is cost. Outlay in respect of pay will be less if they are subcontractors. Also, the arrangements will be less complex, and there's perhaps more ability to have more flexible work structures if they are independent contractors. So, but certainly the prospect of less employment rights, less benefits, such as holiday pay, etc., applying, may make it attractive for a number of employers to avoid worker status rather than have that status.
So ultimately, it's commercially and financially viable and suited toward Uber and other employers to have their workforce as contractors, independent contractors, rather than as workers or employees.
Yes, I mean, it's particular. You find this particularly in some parts of the economy, that this work structure is favoured over a worker structure or employee structure. And unfortunately, typically, quite often affects the most vulnerable members of society.
Now, Uber have said that they want their drivers to be independent contractors, and the drivers are saying that, no, in fact, they are workers. What did they argue? What did they put to the court to demonstrate that they were, in fact, workers and not self-employed contractors?
Typically, this scenario arises, and the worker will be saying, well, the aspiring worker or the individual that seeks to be classified as a worker will say, look at the reality of the situation. Do not just look at the contract, but look at what happened. And in terms of control, that's one of the most important factors. And so what the drivers were saying and what the court found as well is that there were a number of factors that signified that control was being held by Uber in respect of the drivers, and that tended to show a worker relationship rather than that of independent subcontractor. And the 5 points are, when a ride was booked through Uber, it was Uber that set the fare, and the drivers couldn't charge more, for example. So Uber was dictating how the drivers were paid. Second of all, the contractual terms were imposed by Uber. The driver had no say at all in the terms. Thirdly, Uber constrains the driver's freedom to choose when to work once they were logged into the app. It also, fourthly, controlled the way in which the service was delivered. You'll be aware that there was a rating system as well, which is passed on to the passenger. And if a driver failed to maintain their rating system, they could actually end in a contract termination. And fifthly, Uber restricted drivers' ability to communicate with passengers. Anyone who has lost an item of belonging will know how difficult it is to get in touch with a driver. So the communications between the driver and passenger were restricted, and so only so far as it was necessary for the journey to take place. And this scenario differs from what we understand to be an independent contracting scenario. For example, Uber drivers have less ability to improve their economic position through professional or entrepreneurial skills. the only way that they can actually earn more money is by working longer hours. And so that differs from what you would find normally in an independent contractor situation. There's also the regulatory requirement here that's different. Because of the regulatory requirement, drivers did not contract directly with clients. It had to operate via Uber as the principal in accepting bookings. Uber drivers also assume personal service. The driver cannot send a substitute. And that's also an indicative factor as to whether you're a contractor or not.
So given the level of control and the reality of the contract and the reality of the work that the drivers were doing, this begs a question as to when we look at the rest of the gig economy and other platforms and service providers that offer or operate in a similar fashion, how is this judgment going to affect these other industries going forward?
Yes, well, the first thing to state is that clearly the court has adopted a purposive approach. It's saying that the primary question is one of statutory interpretation, not contractual interpretation. And that's quite important because it's looking at the way that these rights, which were statutory rights, created by legislation as opposed to contractual rights. And so that's quite important. And I see it in a way as AutoCleanse, which was a previous decision of the Supreme Court, being remastered or rebooted. And it talks about the purpose of the legislation being primary. Once this is recognised, it can immediately be seen that it would be inconsistent with the purpose of the legislation to treat the written terms of contract as the starting point in determining whether an individual falls within a definition of worker. To do so would reinstate the mischief which the legislation was enacted to prevent. It then goes on to say at paragraph 76, laws such as the National Minimum Wage Act were manifestly enacted to protect those whom Parliament considers to be in need of protection and not just those who are designated by their employer as qualifying for it. And so it's imperative really to provide protection to vulnerable individuals who have little or no say over their pay and working conditions. And it would, as we say, be contrary to the purpose of that legislation to treat the contract as overriding that. So, as I say, AutoCleanse was the precursor, and Uber, I think, has taken it one stage further. The abiding feature here is that the contract is a factor, but not determinative, and you must examine the reality of the relationship between the parties. But if you look at this case in the round, how does it affect the gig economy? I think it's quite important. Now, I understand that Uber themselves are seeking to restrict and narrow the effect of this case, and Uber are saying that it only applies to those named in the case and that the factual situation has changed since the case was first heard in 2016. However, I think that's incorrect. I don't think that narrow interpretation will apply. This is a UK Supreme Court decision and it will be used as precedent, and it will undoubtedly affect the gig economy on a wider scale. I see it really as a part and parcel of an evolution and progression of workers' rights within the gig economy, which hopefully we are seeing protection of some of the most vulnerable workers. What you will see from these decisions is that if you are a worker, you will have those rights I mentioned earlier, and they may be able to claim back pay for up to around 2 years, potentially more in a county court. And they'd be entitled to annual leave. And they'd also have some protection in terms of whistleblowing rights and other statutory rights. And so I see it as being part of a progression. If you look back to November last year, you saw the case, the IWUGB, the Independent Workers Union of Great Britain, High Court action, where gig economy workers were granted rights to PPE, and also the right to stop working in response to serious and imminent danger. So you can see it within a collective of a movement towards protection of vulnerable workers in the UK. And I certainly think that's a good thing.
So a lot of positives that are there for the individual to protect those that are vulnerable, as you've said. But how will this affect Uber? What's the fallout that might occur for Uber in this case?
Yes, I mean, potentially Uber is going to be hit with a number of claims. Of course, these particular claims will be remitted back to the ET to be determined. What might happen is the trade unions may be very active in bringing additional claims or seeking the actual, you know, compensation in terms of having workers' rights. And so this can be costly. And inevitably, an element of this is likely to be passed on to the consumer. And so whilst I don't think Uber is going to go out of business, I doubt it. It hasn't gone out of business elsewhere where there's been similar actions taken. However, Uber may pass on part of the costs to the customer. And so we may have an increase in our fares. And of course, one of the things that attracted everyone to Uber was the fact that it was cheap. But also the fact that it's cheap means that drivers do not get paid very much. So I think if it means that workers are going to have better rights and benefits, then it's probably fair and appropriate that we do pay more for that, ultimately.
Well, I think personally, I would be quite comfortable knowing that the drivers were being treated fairly and appropriately if that meant that my fares were going up.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Elaine. It's been very interesting having this discussion with you, and I look forward to seeing how this judgment plays out in terms of the gig economy moving forward.
Yes, what the future holds, we don't know, but I'm certainly looking forward to see how it unfolds.
Well, thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this episode and Elaine's knowledgeable insight, you can find more episodes like this and more from Elaine, where she discussed positive action and 10 years of the Equality Act on 7BR's website. Thank you and goodbye.